Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name is Sue Supriano, and I am at a meeting of the National Council for Research on Women here at Mills College. This is the annual conference of Women's Leadership Institute, and I have the good fortune here to be talking with two women. One is Palestinian, the other one is Israeli, and they're both here in the United States. Rabab Abduladi is assistant professor of sociology and a faculty fellow at the Center for the Study of Gender and Sexuality at New York University. She's originally from Nablus, Palestine, and is politically active. She got a PhD in sociology from Yale. I could go on a lot more, but I won't use the time doing that. Simona Sharoni is the executive director of the Peace and Justice Studies Association. She is from in Washington State right now, right?
I'm at the Evergreen State College in Washington State.
She spoke this morning a lot about Rachel Corrie, who was run over by a caterpillar, in the occupied territories. She's the author of Gender in the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, The Politics of Women's Resistance, and has worked extensively on solidarity building with Palestinian women. So, as I say, I'm very fortunate to be talking with both of these women. The name of this conference is Borders, Babies, and Bombs, a Gendered Reframing of Security. So, although we have a wide range of different subjects, they kind of all fall under human security. So let's just start with that. Rabab, would you like to begin?
I guess what I wanted to do at this conference and what I raised in my talk, and what I would like to raise again, is the way in which security gets framed by states that dominate and occupy other people. And specifically, I talked about three things. One is how Israel invokes the concept security in order to, in its continued occupation of Palestinian lands and denial of Palestinian rights, and how that concept security is always thought of in terms of Israeli security, but not in terms of Palestinians needing human security. So what happens then is that we end up actually talking about the aggressor needing security without thinking about the dominated needing it more. Okay. And so that's one aspect of it. The second aspect is this: the question of the United States actually going to war against Afghanistan. It's not war. I don't think it's even the right word for it. I think it's total leveling of two countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, within a year, and in the name of national security. And it's really problematic because security doesn't come from without. Security comes from within. And the United States, instead of actually trying to think about why is it that 9/11 happened, what caused it to happen, it's a tragedy, it's a horrible thing. But why did it happen? Instead of addressing the reasons for it, the United States government goes and bombs and levels other people's lives, destroys their fabrics, destroys who they are, and does not think about that violence begets more violence instead of what you need to do is to actually minimize the violence, not increase it.
Well, I've just got to say here that I think that some people in the United States were involved in making September 11th happen, so we won't get off into that. But I think it's quite, on purpose, and that it's a long-term plan, and that was just used as a justification, and that's a whole bunch of programs. And sometimes I think, what you're saying is still, whoever did it, it's still true. Violence promotes more violence, and it just doesn't make any sense for the reasons that they say, anyway.
Yeah, and I think that one of, to tie the two things, the the three cases, let's say, together, the most recent case about which I spoke yesterday, Palestine, Iraq, and the United States, I think there is much more to be talked about in terms of providing security in the sense of this framework of human security, mm-hmm. which may seem sort of like an inexplainable concept, but I think it's really simple to think about what do people need? What do people need to have security? What do people need? They need roof over their heads. They need food on the table. They need to be able to go to work. They need to be free from fear. They need to be not worried about their family members and loved ones and people around them being bombed and killed. They want to be free to travel back and forth and move without checkpoints and borders and so on. And they want to be able to actually have the enjoyment of life. And when you are constantly bombed, when you're constantly injured, attacked, and your land is taken, your homes are being demolished, you can't even have access to the simple notion of having happiness in your life, of having a smile. And this is what's happening to the Palestinians, to the Iraqis, to the Afghanistan people, and to most people in the United States.
Yeah, and so many people in the United States don't understand what it's like to be in that situation of the Palestinians and the Iraqis.
That's because for some reason this conflict has been on one hand simplified and dumbed down in terms of what are the basic issues at its core, and on the other hand made to feel very complex to ordinary people. So they don't want to touch it. They think that, you know, you have to be, a doctoral student or an expert journalist to understand it. Well, the truth of the matter is that the more you watch the mainstream media, the less you know about what's at the root of the conflict. And the crux of what Rabab is getting at, you know, has two major issues. One is the power inequalities that structure this particular conflict and structure almost every conflict that we confront these days. You know, most of the conflicts are between the haves and the have-nots, and it could be, access to certain resources. It could be land and water and basic human rights and the basic tenets of what security is that Rabab described. And the other one is implicit and explicit racism that underlies some of this politics, where we don't think of their security as in a similar way that we think of our security, what we need to feel secure and safe, and we fail to understand that their security is intertwined with ours, that the more insecure we render others, whether it's Palestinians or Afghanis or Iraqis, the more insecure we are, regardless of who was behind the 9/11 thing. I mean, another war is not going to make the U.S. more friends in the Middle East, and I'm using very moderate language. The other point that I think is very important and has silenced many people in this country is the charge of anti-Semitism that is leveled against anyone who dares criticizing Israel's policy in the West Bank and Gaza and U.S. complicity and, you know, not only tacit, but explicit support of these policies. It particularly affects American Jews who, as a result of a very sophisticated and not so sophisticated Israeli PR, were basically bullied into supporting anything Israel does in their names, whether verbally or with tax dollars. And anytime someone speaks critically of Israel, they equate that with, anti-Semitism. And they cannot separate the criticism of Israeli policy. And the question that one is asked, today I focused on a very clear case of a targeting of a U.S. citizen who did solidarity work, who actually tried to do what the international community should have done, upholding U.N. resolution and international convention, which the U.S. and Israel repeatedly violate. She went there because the U.N. failed to send international observers. She went there to stand against house demolitions. And then at the end of my presentation, the first question that I got asked, it wasn't publicly, by someone at this conference was, so don't you think Israel has a right to exist? And how the woman took out of my presentation that, how was she able to respond to the tears in her own eyes and to this human story with this defensive posture of trying to reinterpret what I said, to silence me. And I had to go and delineate all my own history and my father's Holocaust experience and, you know, basically list all my family members that live in Israel, because all of them do, and actually reply tongue-in-cheek and said, you know, Israel probably won't exist much longer if the occupation continues. In many ways, it will exist physically, but the society is imploding. But I should only say it because I care for Israel. I think, again, we get to the point that it's intertwined. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people that get involved because they care about their own people, but it is understanding that you people are involved in causing other people suffering, that doing it in your name, you have to stop it, and that the process of remaining silent on them dehumanizes you as a citizen.
Do you know the amount of money that the United States gives Israel? I know it gives Israel more just a huge amount of money.
More than $5 billion per year in aid. And sort of like goes about probably a little bit over two in military and some in economic. And then there is all the other things that are cushioned in various bills. But the loan guarantees, there is all sorts of bills that in which aid to Israel is cushioned. And then there is also the loan guarantees that the Israeli government has gotten, by which the United States actually guarantees loans Israel gets from world banking systems. So what happens is that instead of the, and this is in direct violation, by the way, of U.S. Law as it stands today. I'm not talking even about the law as it stood before Patriot 1 and Patriot 2. It still exists today that Israel violates, historically has violated the U.S. end user certificate, giving weapons it buys from the U.S. it gets from the U.S. to other regimes that are so repressive that the U.S. government is not allowed to sell to, at the time, the Guatemalans, the Nicaraguans, the Salvadorans, etc., etc., Chile, and so on. And
used to be South Africa.
South African apartheid. And they actually exploded the nuclear. They did a nuclear test together during Carter mm-hmm. in 1979, but it sort of like got hidden. That's not weapons of mass destruction. But that's one aspect. The second aspect of it is that the United States suggests actually that people who buy weapons from the U.S. or get aid from the U.S. and violate U.S. Record of human rights should not be getting that aid. So on the State Department, which releases its human rights report every year in January, actually comes up year after year saying that Israel violates Palestinian human rights, which is a basic thing. Closure of the schools, curfews, house demolitions, the economy, the checkpoints, etc., 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 all of the stuff that's going on. And the Israel continues taking it. And on top of it, something weird is going on in Washington. Something I don't think it's, I mean, weird in the sense that it's unexplainable, but I think it's unforgivable. For instance, the Senator Santorum, in Washington has actually pushed for a clause in a law to pass a legislation under, quote-unquote, ideological diversity, by which every school in the United States, every university in the United States, which engages in criticizing Israel, will be denied public funding. Which means that you actually basically saying that it's okay, Israel, go ahead, kill Palestinians, take their land, you know, throw them in prison, put checkpoints, starve them to death. It's fine because anybody who dares criticize you, it even goes more beyond accusations of anti-Semitism. This is actually penalizing academic institutions for doing what they're supposed to be doing, teaching about what's going on, presenting different sides of the issue.
Oh, that's incredible. I haven't heard that. I mean, I'm not doubting it. I mean, because there's just so much horrible stuff going on. You just heard from Rabab Abdulladi, who is a professor in New York University. And we're also speaking with Simona Sharoni, who is a professor at Evergreen College in Oregon. And in Washington, I always do that. I have friends from that school also. And she's also the executive director of the Peace and Justice Studies Association. So, yeah, it is really an incredible thing, one of those totally unfair fights in terms of Israel and Palestinians. So
people here should know that, I mean, you know, it is there, but the whole thing is done, as you pointed out, and we elaborated with our tax dollars, and a country that prides itself for being able, for instigating regime changes, something that, of course, you know, neither one of us supports here, but, you know, negotiates now or talks to Sharon, who is Israel's prime minister, who has been indicted as a war criminal. They're not talking about regime change in Israel, which, you know, we're not calling for a war to be waged against Israel, but we have leverage. You know, we have leverage. We are funding that occupation. This is happening, the daily violation of people's basic rights, the house demolitions, the daily killings of Palestinian women and children, the conditions that breed violence there are made possible with our tax dollars, with the silence of most of our elected officials. And those people should be, I mean, those people claim, the congressmen and the congresswomen and the senators who may, on one hand, you know, challenge some of this in private, but never vote, never put their money where their mouth is, justified by saying that their constituency won't support them. And when we speak around the country repeatedly, we see people that actually understand. When you break it down to them, when you put a human face about on what's happening there, when you compare the daily conditions that people have to deal with in the West Bank and Gaza with what people contend here, people are able to empathize and see the connections, and then they, some of them urge their elected official to change. So there's got to be a change. We have to uphold our government to do something there, and it has to stop. And it's impossible that this country prides itself of playing a role in dismantling apartheid and in being a leader of the world and remains completely silent and turns a blind eye at what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza, because what is happening right now there is worse than what has happened during apartheid in South Africa. And, you know, the new roadmap that has been embraced uncritically, not only by the mainstream media, but also by some, you know, liberals or so-called liberals in this country, is not going to end that, because it doesn't have, it doesn't address the basic issues at the heart of this conflict. You know, the question of refugees, the question of settlements, the final borders. It doesn't really deal with the resources. It is simply a document about process, and this is not how you end this injustice. So we've got to educate ourselves, and we've got to hold our government accountable, and people, you know, people should just link with groups in their communities that are doing it and get involved.
Well, you know, so many things are not as they seem. I mean, you can be a war criminal and still get the get a peace prize these days. So, and there's a whole issue of the Israeli lobby, the Zionists in the United States. It is a very complicated, you know, I don't know if it's complicated. There's layers of information that people don't really have access to, basically. I want to get to some positive work that you do.
I think it's really important to understand that even with all the complications, every issue is complicated. But every issue is also about justice and injustice. Mm-hmm. This is about the question of justice and injustice. And if we actually believe that freedom is indivisible, if we're really promoting feminism in the sense that we're actually looking at women's lives as interlinked, all sorts of things are interlinked, then we have to treat Palestine the same way. We cannot say, okay, it applies everywhere except to Palestine. And I think in that sense that one of the encouraging things is that there are more and more and more people getting involved. That when there were demonstrations on February 15th around the world, and the slogan was the world says no to war, and the world did, and the only two countries in the world which were so strongly supportive of the war were the U.S. and Israel. Britain, but I mean, the population, there was more percentage of the population supporting the war in the U.S. and in Israel, as opposed to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So there's something wrong with the U.S. and Israel actually being all the way on their own, with the whole humanity saying, hello, there is something wrong with this. You guys have to stop. And you could see the Palestine flag. You could see the people from all over the world supporting, because it's a question about justice and injustice. It's a question about freedom. So we are encouraged. If we weren't encouraged, we wouldn't be sitting here today. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be doing what we are doing in these gloomy days, because in the end, people continue to resist. The question is, do we want to prolong the suffering, or we want to shorten the suffering in order to produce some kind of, you know, the human rights to which everyone is entitled?
All right. Absolutely. I would like to hear from you, Simona Cerroni, about your Peace and Justice Studies Association and the kind of work that you do. I'm sorry that we have so little time. And I must say, because I live here in Berkeley, I get a lot of information about the Israeli-Palestinian and a lot of information about what goes on in the occupied territories. But I realize that most people don't. Yes. So
that's great. And the challenge is always to share it with others. And that's one of the things that we do as the Peace and Justice Studies Association. We have the noble and difficult task of trying to network almost on a daily basis three constituencies that work on similar issues but don't have the opportunity to meet and work together very often. University students and professors who do work on peace and justice issues broadly defined, and this conference is about women's issues, but those are, you know, social justice issues. So it's people that do work in women's studies, peace studies, conflict resolution, international politics, or scholars that do work in mathematics but are very passionate about those issues, but who make a living or spend most of the time in the academy, and undergraduate and graduate students with K-12 teachers and grassroots activists. And I want to say a word about K-12 teachers. Being a teacher these days in this country is really not a very easy job. And so what we do is provide support for teachers that raise questions of social justice in the classroom. There are teachers that were put on leave without pay in some schools around the country for even staging a debate in class about alternatives to war, to a U.S. attack on Iraq. We help to write curriculum and disseminate existing curriculum and link together progressive teachers. And there are groups of radical teachers, critical teachers, that have sprung around the country during this war, and that's very encouraging. I work very closely with a group in the Northwest of people that see the job in an elementary and high school to kind of cultivate activists, and we put them in touch with the activist community. It's so important for us to recognize that we have a privilege in our classroom. And we have some privilege as academics, but to bridge that divide between academics and activists. We have an annual conference, and our conference is upcoming in October. If people want to find out more information about the Peace and Justice Studies Association, they can go to www.peacejusticestudies.org and find more information about that and the conference.
And you were talking earlier about some of the things that you do in your own classes in Evergreen.
Well, I mean, I really try to make a connection with the lives of students. I think both Rabab and I think one of the things that we do is, weave our personal story into this. I mean, we did not go to the academy because we see it as an end in and of itself. We see our work in the academy as part and parcel of our activism. It's a means to an end. Education is a tool for social change. So the classroom is a place to expand our horizons, but also to challenge one another. We welcome students challenging us, as well as to agitate people to make a difference, to really move what they learn beyond the classroom, to act on it, and bring issues from their own lives and experiences into the classroom so that they are to be interrogated. So we actually push the boundaries of the disciplines and the issues that we address to be more about real people and real issues in the real world. So, I mean, when dealing with militarization, I take my students to a military base in a country where militarization has become a centerpiece of the economy, in a state where there are 8 military bases. I cannot simply talk about militarization in Israel-Palestine because for them it would be this exotic experience that their professor had. I have to take them. So they go to a military base. So they see how that military base has blended itself into the community and became a centerpiece. So they begin to problematize the front page paper where you see the homecoming of soldiers coming in and hugging their kids. And there's a human face on the military and the soldier, but it's not the same for those of us who are peace activists. So I try to do a lot of kind of bringing the real world into the classroom and sending the students into the real world.
Uh-huh. That's great. I mean, that same soldier who's hugging his children might have just killed somebody else's children, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. What do you
want? Well, we're kind of running. We're just about at the end here, so I'd like to know if you have any closing words, Rabab Abduladi.
Well, I want to actually comment on that. I was going to speak about my classes, but don't have much time to do it. But I think it's this is the biggest challenge, is how do we understand that there is an institution behind the individual person who hugs his children and has quote unquote normal life when they go and when they're part of actually an institution that kills, that destroys other people's lives. And I think there needs to be an understanding in our minds and in the minds of the people with whom we come into contact, students or other people, to make that distinction, but to also understand that there is something about the institution that is very destructive to the soldier who goes and hugs his children, because inevitably that soldier who goes and shoots and kills other people is going to turn that violence at some point towards his own family or his own community and so on. So there is something wrong about this establishment that only destroys. There is something wrong with that you produce things to actually destroy other things rather than to produce things to promote life. There is something wrong about that. And that point really needs to be driven home, that during the bombing of Iraq, we were saying that, yes, we do care about the troops who were economically drafted. We want them to come home because we don't want them to rob Iraqis of their life and their humanity, and we don't want them to be robbed themselves of their humanity and their life by becoming aggressors and killing machines. So this is the way to think about this, not to think about it segmentally. And, you know, and I agree with Simone's analysis and what you said in that. So I think this is our biggest challenge, and it seems people are listening to the message because the ranks are growing bigger.
Well, that's good news, and we got to end. It's really good to end on some good news because there's little of it. So I want to remind people that my guests have been Rabab Abduladi from NYU, New York University, and Simone Sharoni, who is from Evergreen State College in Washington State. And we are here at the national at a conference called Borders, Babies, and Bombs, a Gendered Reframing of Security in Oakland, California. And thank you very much. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thank you for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.